Welcome to C2Y Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care. My name is Wolfgang Vashon. In North America, we increasingly use the phrase child and youth care practitioners to define a particular approach to working with young people. This approach is defined by characteristics, beliefs, orientations, and practices. Various bodies, such as the Association for Child and Youth Care Practice or the Council of Canadian Child and Youth Care Associations, helps define what constitutes this approach. The literature of the field, such as Garfat and Fulcher's article, Characteristics of a Child and Youth Care Approach, or Garabagi and Stewart's Right Here, Right Now, Exploring Life Space Interventions for Children and Youth, also inform practitioners. There are many common themes that emerge when one looks at what child and youth care practice is, and there are also unique context-specific differences. Some approaches are explicitly therapeutic, others recreational or educational. Most are relationship-based, some voluntary, others imposed. There are aspects that primarily focus on changing the person, while others focus on changing the structures around the person. The role of the practitioner is one that is ever-evolving. Counselor, friend, guide, ally. When CYC practitioners look outside of North America, a further diversity of approaches and practices open up. Over the past several months, we've been hearing perspectives of practice from different parts of the world. We continue this international learning today. In much of continental Europe, there's an approach to working across the lifespan called social pedagogy. It blends many of the diverse approaches that are used in North America into a unified construct of how to work with young people. Today, I'm speaking with Sylvia Holthoff from THEMPRA, an abbreviation of Theory Meets Practice. Sylvia is going to speak about social pedagogy, and together we will explore some of the differences and overlaps between child and youth care practice as it is constructed in North America and social pedagogy as practiced in Europe. Welcome to C2Y Podcast, Sylvia. Good morning. So let's start with the obvious question, which is, what is social pedagogy?
That's a good question, because if you would ask that in the European context, it's something where you will have diverse definitions around. And I think it would be just good to start in actually explaining the term. The social, of course, stands for the social being us, more than one person interacting in a group, interacting in society. And yeah, social pedagogy in that sense, meaning coming from the Greek terms of again, standing for leading, and pes for child, that it's around a person leading another in the process of development, helping them, being alongside them, enabling them, that they can sort of resource all the potentials that they have. And it's this process that social pedagogy is actually about, this around that other person and trying to enable them to reach their full potential. So there's a lot of terms, and one of the definitions coming from the UK from Claire Cameron and Pat Petrie, who did a lot of research into the continental approach, is that it sees social pedagogy as education in the broadest sense, that it is something that is much wider than the schooling aspect. It's something that takes place outside of school, outside of families. It's something that is actually leading a process where the person that we are working with, sort of are interacting with, is experiencing something where they're learning for themselves, more than in the sense of an outcome or of just a content, but actually something that they can draw on as a person. There's something that we developed from THEMPRA, a model called the Diamond Model, which developed from something when we're introducing social pedagogy to the UK, people were saying it's so hard to grasp social pedagogy and how can you capsulize it in 4 or 5 words. So we drew up this model, which actually has the different terms of well-being and happiness, relationship, holistic learning and empowerment, and positive experiences at its center. And that actually says, is the gist of social pedagogy, of looking at how can we enhance as a person next to another, as a social pedagogue, how can we enhance the well-being on a long-term basis with the person we are working with, how can we go into that a relationship that actually enhances that well-being, that is not just focused on that one moment, but on a long-term basis? And how can we initiate happiness in the moment where we are there? And happiness not always meaning the sort of party and smiling and having giggles. It can be at times actually going through some really hard times and actually acknowledging something and going through a mourning process that can bring well-being and happiness to someone. And from a sociopedagogic perspective, that can only happen through actually initiating holistic learning, meaning that it's not only around concerning the head, the thinking of the person we're working with or having a relationship with, but actually trying to involve their emotions in that learning process, making them actually experience on a different level what they are talking and thinking around, and if possible, actually putting some acting towards it. So actually it's around enabling a learning process that then becomes much deeper and very activating for the person, because they don't know only about what they're talking, but they know what they're doing and how to do it. That's often the feedback we get from people who endeavor the journey of social pedagogy, that they feel that they're actually able to put their learning into practice, or a lot of things that they have learned through the social pedagogy approach, to put it into practice. And it's very relational based. Social, as I was saying in the Diamond Model, it's around trying to initiate a relationship that is on an equal base with the person we are working with. That doesn't mean that me as a pedagogue, I don't have responsibility for that situation or that there are boundaries. It is around actually being on more equal terms with each other and understanding it as a dual learning process. I'm not the only one who's actually giving something into this situation. It's actually the young person as well. And that doesn't mean that I'm just learning some kind of facts or procedures or things to do from that child or that person I'm working with. It's actually that it's something where I'm learning around that person. I'm learning for myself. So it's around recognizing it's not only me bringing something to the situation, but actually acknowledging that I'm getting something back from that person as well. And that must be always, from a social pedagogy stance, be in context with reflection. Because if we as social pedagogues don't reflect on what we're doing in those relationships, we often, tend to probably go into the area of our own personal interests or private areas, and that's something that shouldn't be in that relationship. It's about being personal but not being private. There's a quite distinguished difference between that from a social pedagogy perspective. So it's about empowering relationship that we're trying to create, and sometimes it might be even a relationship that becomes uncomfortable for me if I'm talking about empowerment, because empowerment from our understanding is actually that it is to become uncomfortable for me as a pedagogue. If I want that other person to speak out, to maybe question something, to be more, have a thinking of their own mind and put it to action in context with society and so on, then it might, for me, might become uncomfortable for me as the other person, and I might be questioned. But that's actually something where I want that other person to go to, because empowerment isn't around getting them to think what I think. It's around that they're able to think for themselves and actually put into practice what they're thinking about. But this draws me to the point of the social. It's social pedagogy is always in relation to moral education or moral aspects of where we're living in, the society. Social pedagogy is very much linked to the society that we are living in and tries to draw on the reflexive process between the individual and society. So for me, as a social pedagogue, I'm in the role, in the obligation to actually make society aware of where the individual is and what their needs and circumstances are, so that they can be included into society, or more included and not so marginalized. And vice versa, I need to help that person I'm working with to actually see the society and maybe see where they can find their place in that society and enable them to find that space. And not by, again, the leading aspect, not by telling them what I think about it or what's useful for the society in that sense, where they are productive, but actually, for them as a person to see how they fit in and how they can contribute as a individual in a functioning society.
Wow, that's great, Sylvia. That there's lots and lots and lots of stuff there, and I'm super excited about what you said. I'd like to, if we could, just sort of tease some of those things apart for us. So you started with the idea of leading another, pedagogy is leading another, and leading them around to help them reach their own potential. What does that look like in practice? So in relationship to a young person, how do we help them reach their potential?
I think there's a notion around what we call life world orientation, and that's my starting point as a social pedagogue. I have to take a different stance. I have to divert myself from my own thinking and what has taken an impact on me, and try to see through the lens of the person I'm working with. That can never happen to the full, but it's about empathizing where they come from, first of all, and something that might have a meaning for me might not have a meaning for themselves. I was, just as an explanation, I was working with a young girl, and we were going to a supermarket, and she was cramping a lot of food, and I didn't know why she was spending all her money, all that I had sort of available for her, on food, just groceries. And I thought, well, she would have the opportunity to spend it on ice cream or herself. But then actually in the dialogue afterwards and going home with her, it was a recognition. It was the end of the month and their fridge was empty. So her life world orientation wasn't ice cream or candy or going on a scooter. Her life world orientation was that her fridge was empty. And that's just a small, it's something really minute, but it's something that's important. If I want to actually be alongside a person I'm working with and actually help them and support them and lead them in their development, I have to take their point of view in certain things. That doesn't mean I have to agree with them or say, oh, that's good and that has to stay. But a lot of actions that we as human beings put to the world are led by the life world that we've experienced up until then, the life world that has an impact on us, the circumstances. So that's my starting point when I'm actually getting into meeting someone and trying to pick up a relationship, trying to see where they're coming from through different kind of resources, how they act, how they speak, what they express about themselves, and then not staying with interpretations or assumptions, but then trying to verify my ideas I have about that person in my head. And social pedagogy is very hands-on, so it's around quickly identifying what is the interest of that other person, what makes them tick. And yeah, it might be football, so it might be for me, who's not a football player, but actually to think around how can I get into a relationship through using a common thread, an activity that will join us and get us active together, because there's much more happening between people in experiencing something together. They have something that joins them. They have something they can talk about. They have something, hopefully, if it goes positive, that gels them, etc., etc. So it's around picking them up where they are, trying to find out their interests, getting into finding out how can that be made, you know, how can you do something with that young person in some sense, what they find interesting. And that might be football, it might be baking, it might be just going out, going to a animal home and getting an animal and just taking it walkies or whatever. It's not about big money or big activities. It's often very small things that they like and where it's important to show interest and use them as a means to create relationship. I think that's something that's very intrinsic to social pedagogy, that active part of doing things together and finding those means, the common ground where you can find the place then to create relationships.
Yes, I mean, the life world orientation, it reminds me a lot of, in North America, we talk around about life space and we talk about, the physical dimension, where people are physically. So that, in your case, could be the grocery store. We talk about the mental dimension, how they perceive the life that they're living. We talk about the relational dimension, how we are in relationship vis-a-vis each of our own social locations. And then we also talk about the virtual dimension, which is both the fantasies of the person as well as fantasies, hallucinations, imaginations, as well as the, you know, as you and I are speaking on Skype, that virtual, the virtual networks, social networks, and entering into all those different spaces. The learning for themselves. So, you know, what I'm hearing you say is we are, you know, as a social pedagogue, you are a presence in their life. You are, it almost feels like a guide in their life. How do you, as you enter their life space to, you know, support them, how do you foster that learning for themselves?
I think it's around very much giving the learning to them in the sense of making them, it's, you know, encouraging them to endeavor or creating a learning situation and actually making them aware it's not that they don't have to do it for me or for anyone else. It's only if they want to do it. We often explain it in the model of challenge by choice or the learning zone model from Tom Zenninger, which we use, that you actually, the learning zone, you don't know where it's happening or not. And it's actually everyone for themselves as a person decides for them if they want to learn or not. And it's around making children aware that, or the persons that we work with, that it's around that we like to foster or nurture the intrinsic motivation. So, for example, if it's around that a child is in the process of starting to read, then it's around inviting him or her in diverse ways to doing that, but also giving it back in the sense if they don't buy into it, and actually saying, well, it's up to you if you want to decide, you know, if you decide you want to learn reading, I'm happy here to support you with it. But at the end of the day, it needs to be your decision. You don't have to do it for me. It's, if you don't want to buy into it, you will be the one who will actually even have the consequences for it. So it's not around trying to pressure them into anything by using emotional blackmail or buying them with any gadgets or bribes or whatever. It's actually trying to motivate them to get the sense for that they're doing it for themselves. And then it sometimes does become uncomfortable, where you then as a pedagogue have to stand to other people and say, you know, be protective in front of them and say, well, he decided not to do it and that's fine. He needs that time to, yeah, come to that place, or he needs more time. And that then gives me the opportunity, or often gives the young person a more trusting relationship to me as a pedagogue as well, if I don't stand there and actually, don't shelter him from other people as well. I'm an advocate for that person in many ways.
Right. Yeah. So you become that ally, you become that advocate, you become, you know, more about supporting that individual's agency rather than imposing the structures. And I think there's a lot of tensions in North America in particular around the role of a CYC practitioner having to focus upon the structures, right? So as an educator, There's a lot in the U.S., for example, there's a lot of what we call out-of-school programming, which has an explicitly educational focus. So it is, what are people doing outside of the school hours? And often it's to augment or supplement the formal education. And so the role of the youth worker then becomes to help the young person with reading, with math, et cetera, et cetera. And it's measured by the CYC practitioners, the youth workers' ability to get that young person to read. What I'm hearing you say is just the opposite, that what you're trying to do is develop that young person's capacity to make choices for themselves and understand the consequences of those choices. Would that be accurate?
Yes. And I think it's around recognizing in the long term and having the experience around it that that pathway might be a more long term and a strenuous one at the beginning, but often enough by the end of it or at one sort of part, the person, the learner, then becomes very self-directed in its learning and often doesn't need any prompting anymore. And it is often that if you don't recognize those blocks, and sometimes they're emotional blocks that are coming from a totally different area, and just try to get in the content, it won't work. And I think that's where teachers, for example, struggle very much if they don't have a pedagogical, haven't had the opportunity to experience pedagogical skills in that sense, where they can then, try to take it from a different stance. For example, in a home in an organization we worked in the UK, we had a group of young boys who collectively decided not to go to school anymore, and they were out of school for quite a considerable length of time, and everybody was pressuring and saying they need to go back, they need to go back, and they were using all kinds of means. And then actually social pedagogy was introduced and the practitioners became much more reflective and stepped back from the pressure and actually looked for what is of interest for the young people. And they came to the theme of football again, sorry, but yes, and they got active. They got active in their community. They interacted more with people. Then it was after some time the practitioners picked it up. What relates to football? You need to be physically fit. What nutritions do you need? You know, how fast do you have to run? So it became step by step a bit more content orientated and educational. And they got so upbeat in their self-confidence and their self-value that they were then able to be included into the schooling process, the formal schooling process again. And it was a substantial, a sustainable process that then happened. It was nothing where it, after 3 months, it broke down again. So, which often happened beforehand. So it's around having taken that reflective stance sometimes and getting out of that hamster loop and actually looking, is this what we are doing really conducive to the learning of that person I'm with? Or is it just, is it he or she just complying to something but actually hasn't got an understanding and isn't probably not able to put it into practice if they would be on their own?
Right. And that's one example. As you speak, I teach at a college here in Canada, and I feel all my teacher reflexes kicking up. I have this curriculum. Yeah. I have this agenda. I have this information that I need to impart and then assess if it's been done. And so I can certainly appreciate. So, that's one example. And do you see this work? I'm reminded in your story of, the old Summerhill project by A.S. Neal, back in the 60s, where students went to class when they were ready to go to class and they could play until then. And it always rang somewhat idealistic to me. Do you see it working in practice? You gave me one example. You don't need to give me more examples, but can you say that yes, it does work in practice across different contexts?
I think if we sort of focus on education, formal education, I think it's social pedagogy helps education to strike a balance, I think, at times. I think since, especially in Germany and other sort of joining countries since the 70s wave, a lot of social pedagogy aspects have gone into school, and there are a lot of progressive schools that use a more holistic learning methods that actually at the end of the educational process, the children or then young people are actually on the same level of knowledge and able to apply it like children from other schools. But I think the recognition since then, and Summerhill definitely, is that it needs more clear boundaries for the children, for the young people. And I, for myself, I went to a school where I didn't actually have any marks till I was in the 10th grade. So till I was 16, I didn't have any grades in that sense. It was a page per teacher, per subject that I got at the end of a half year, which gave me insight to what they saw from their perspective as my progress in development, in learning content and in socializing with the class and things like that. So I've experienced that kind of learning myself and did my GCSEs or A levels and went to university. The focus much more being on enabling people to learn, to acquire knowledge, and with the recognition that knowledge is so vastly changing, the focus is more on enabling people how to access learning themselves. And I think there needs to be stroken a balance between social pedagogy and formal education. And I think they can feed off each other. And if we're talking about inclusion of people with disability into normal mainstream schooling, what isn't the case in Germany or in the UK, then it definitely needs a more pedagogic, social pedagogic handling to the situation, because then it becomes something, if you don't include it, that doesn't become conducive to anyone.
And what about outside of a formal education context? Where else do we see social pedagogy in practice in Europe?
Well, you will see it often enough. You will have social pedagogues in the German context. They're often more leaders of an organization, or not an organization, but of a small, like a kindergarten or a children's home or an outdoor center, or even in youth work, they're working together, because in Germany, you often qualify as a social worker and as a social pedagogue. It's a dual education, academic discipline, so you'll have both incorporated. You would see it in old people's homes where they're active as well, or organizing groups for old people to have social activities together. So it's across the whole lifespan where you can find it, organizing holiday trips for young people and children, especially in the area of people with disability, etc. In Denmark, you will have social pedagogues being the ones who are actually doing it directly. So the percentage of social pedagogues being in all those organizations or fields I was just mentioning now is much higher. In Germany, we have a vocational qualification. It's called the Erzieher. It's very pedagogical focused, but it's not as widely, it doesn't look wider than the context of the organization often. Social pedagogy aims to look wider than that, be more societally critical, and actually advocate the case of the organization or the individual on a much higher level than the Erzieher would. So it's very, very different in European countries, and the way social pedagogy is being put into practice in the different countries is very different as well. And that's because it's societally linked. We always say to the people when we work in the UK, we can tell you a lot around how it works in Denmark and in Germany or in Belgium and Norway, but it's something that they have to customize to their culture. Their concept of children is so much different. So it needs to be back to live world orientation, it needs to be accustomed to them in the sense of it doesn't need to be made exactly to fit their model. It is there to nudge their kind of thinking around how they work and interact or want to interact with children. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a need to introduce it. But it's around finding the balance between it. If they would just take what we're bringing to them in that way, it would just probably work for the time being while we're there. And after that, it would just collapse because it hasn't been, as I always say, ingrained and it's sort of worked into their sort of kind of societal structures. And that's something that needs to happen. It needs to be worked into the practice, into the person that's working to actually get the ethical understanding of social pedagogy, because social pedagogy is very ethical based. It's not just about applying methods or models or skills. It's around being that person, having a certain kind of stance towards how you want to be in that relationship with that person. How do you want that other person to experience you? And is something that needs to be worked through on a lot of levels. And there's a lot of learning from our side around bringing it to the UK, introducing it to the UK, a lot of learning for us in that process as well.
That notion of what you're learning and the questioning of the practitioners in the UK of how does this fit within your culture, within your society, in it was a special issue of Children Australia, which you co-edited, and the issue is all about social pedagogy and looking at social pedagogy in a Australian context and in relationship to how it's been practiced in Europe. And you raised some questions about how we work with people, and you say that we need to question what we believe children are, how we want to relate to them, what we want them to experience in their childhood, and what role we want them to play within society. What do you believe children are? It's such a curious question to me. What do you believe children are, and how can we work with that across diverse cultures?
I think children are active agents, and they actually have everything in them. And for me, it's important to provide them with the conducive social environment, materialistic environment, so that they're actually able to discover and experience themselves and unfold everything that's within them. And they need that dignified, respectful kind of manner to work with them or to have that relationship with them so they can actually discover their all the resources that they have in themselves. And it's my obligation to make sure, as a person who's alongside that process, to make sure that is happening. And that doesn't mean that I'm sheltering away a lot of adverse circumstances. And as we know from resilience, it's actually there's people who've gone through some really adverse circumstances in their life, and they came out in a shining way, or in a way that no one would have expected. But it's around enabling them to actually see that they can come through that.
I'm intrigued with this notion of resilience, because it's certainly a topic that I've explored a fair amount, and I have many questions of my understanding of social pedagogy as it came out of a horrific experience, that being World War II. And really it was a way to, how do we address this huge population of orphan children? What do we do? How do we support them? Is that correct? Is that the origins of social pedagogy?
The origins, the roots of social pedagogy are much more longstanding than the post-war development. It's something that's started developing in the 18th century through philosophers. That's where the ethical orientation draws from. And it's something that was developed over a long period of time, and that's why it's often sort of termed as a organic discipline by many different pedagogues across the continent, like Maria Montessori, Rudolf Steiner, Janusz Korczak, and so forth. So it's something that's actually Comenius, as philosopher, Pestalozzi, and so on. It's something that that was an idea or a notion from someone, and it's been carried over a long period of time and reshaped and sort of gained new aspects through the society developing, that it's a very long-standing discipline, which only became academic in that sense in the last century, but it has its roots in a long-standing history. So it was, social pedagogy was misused in the Second World War. It was used as an instrument by the Germans to actually indoctrinate certain values, but in a not constructive way. So they were using it in the way that we would use it, but not to the benefit of the state. So it had to be reclaimed after the Second World War, and I think a lot of people were quite shattered of how it actually had been used. And I think the strong critical aspect that Maga draws on, Mollenhauer draws on, is related to that sort of being shocked of what actually has happened, and that we as pedagogues, as social pedagogues, have an obligation to be more critical towards developments in society. Like, for example, if we're looking at all the risk-averse aspects and outcome-focused processes that are trying to be introduced into my practice, I become very skeptical and try to reflect in what might it mean to the person's development or the society that I'm working in, and that I actually not only have the obligation to reflect or reflect on it, but it's actually about voicing it and bringing it somewhere. And luckily, German has quite a good forum of different magazines where these debates, this healthy critical debates, actually happen. So being journals, it's something that's, you know, it's nothing that takes 1.5 years till a book comes out. So it's very immediate dialogue that takes place in that field. And yes, it needed to be reclaimed after the Second World War. And I don't think it was only on the part of all these orphans needing to be looked after and educated and so on. I think it has a different further aspect than that.
This idea of empowering versus social control, that you're speaking of social pedagogy being used, you know, in the German context as an example, as a way of indoctrination or social control, and the relational process, the empowerment process, the disquiet or uncomfortability that comes as a social pedagogue working with young people is something that I would like to go into a little bit now. I was teaching a class the other day, and we were talking about relationships, and we were talking about therapeutic relationships, and I said, is there any relationship that's not therapeutic? And they said, no. And I said, oh, why is that? And they said that, you know, the whole purpose of our work as child and youth care practitioners, as child and youth workers, is about therapy and a therapeutic process, which I very much see as a certain approach. And that approach is about changing the young person to fit into the structure. What I'm hearing you say about, or to navigate the structure, maybe a fairer way of saying that. And what I'm hearing you say is that social pedagogy is equally, if not even more, concerned about how the structure is impacting the young person. Would that be correct, that the analysis of the structure is integral to social pedagogy?
I think it is. I think it is integral in the sense of, in both ways. Funny enough, when you were describing that, I was feeling my one arm going to the one side and the other to the other, feeling torn. In the sense that it is around analyzing the structures to be able to, on the what, as I said before, to be able to yes, support that young person to develop so he actually can fit into the structures, but on the same side, actually giving feedback to the structures or the formers of the structure, being the community, being the city, being in academic texts, whatever, to make them aware where the individual is actually standing, and seeing, using the individual in the sense, thinking around the social of social pedagogy again, using the social, the group, actually to enable the individual to learn about social structures and social interaction and the morals that are actually within society, in their society that they are living in. If I work in the therapeutic one-to-one situation, it's often something that some practitioners really favor that, because it, from their perspective, when you start talking to them, it's less dangerous. It hasn't got as many dynamics as you have when you actually work in group work. But then it takes away so much learning, which I like, around the social. By working with the social, I can help the group, the individual in the group, actually to experience certain situations, contexts that enable them on the long-term perspective, and that's where we're back to empowerment, to actually be able to, for example, have a constructive dialogue that doesn't go out into a row and doesn't escalate. It's things that the people we work with often don't experience in their prior life world. So it's around using the social in that to actually enable or initiate certain kinds of settings or experiences where they then are actually able to experience society on a micro level in a safe way, and they can have some learning around that and or try to do something they haven't tried before. A group can be very supportive in that, and they might not want to try it out in the big society, in the community, but they might feel encouraged to do it in the social. So the social is a quite, the social bubble is a very important one for me in my practice, so that they can actually relate to the social in the societal context, to the societal structures. By actually initiating those things and guiding them and being alongside, sometimes consciously stepping out of them, I can actually put in the moral education into that as well. From my point of view, not in a sort of missionary kind of way or punitive or descriptive, but letting them discover it themselves. You know, what does it mean? If one person does that, what does it mean to the rest of the group, and for them actually to have the open space to discuss it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's the, you know, there's so many questions that every time you say something, I have about 8 more questions that pop into my head. And unfortunately, we don't have the time to explore these questions. I'm interested in that tension between ethical practice and morality / moral indoctrination into the social group that historical normative practice of education. I'm intrigued with how you, as a social pedagogue, you struggle with the discomfort of watching young people display their agency and challenge us. I'm so interested in the question you have around what we get from the person in relationship in social pedagogy, because once again, when I teach, I say that we are here for the other person. It's not about our needs, and yet you're raising questions in there. So there's so many questions that we have, and we don't have time. However, it is a big shame. You are going to be at the World CYC Conference in St. John's, Newfoundland, with a couple other colleagues from ThemPRA. and discussing all of these. And in fact, the title of your talk is Social Pedagogy, Exploring Connections Between European Traditions and CYC. So I'm certainly looking forward to being part of that discussion and asking more questions and learning more. And if anybody else is interested in learning more about THEMPRA, you can go to the Connect to Youth C2Ypodcast.org website or directly to THEMPRA.org. So it's THEMPRA.org. Lots of resources. The diamond model that you spoke with at the beginning is there. There's the international Journal of Social Pedagogy, an open access journal is there, lots and lots of articles. It's a real wealth of information. As we start to wrap up, Sylvia, is there anything else that's pressing that you think we need to know before we end our conversation today?
I think what would be really valuable for me or from the THEMPRA or introducing social pedagogy to other cultures, it's not questioning any other practice. It builds on the good practice that is there, and it is nothing that's revolutionary. And if people get into this dialogue, what is so very much around social pedagogy, getting into dialogue, it's around then actually finding the roots within their culture that relate to social pedagogy and then to retrieve them and actually build on that. So it's nothing where we want people to feel endangered about. It doesn't question them as a person and it doesn't question their good practice either. I think that's quite important.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. Just as the young people that you work with in the social pedagogy are allowed to maintain their core and their sense of agency as they explore the structures and ramifications, we're allowed to keep our core values and beliefs and how we work with children based upon what is a child in the culture we work within, and to layer this on top.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for this wonderful conversation, and I look forward to meeting you in person in St. John's in June.
Me too. Thank you.
All right. Goodbye, Sylvia.
Goodbye.